Welcome to the Cancer Care Connect workshop. At this time, all participants are in a listen-only mode. During the workshop, you will hear from our panel of expert speakers. We will allow time for questions and comments following the presentation. Instructions will be given at that time. If anyone should require assistance during the workshop, please press star then zero on your touchtone telephone. As a reminder, this workshop is being recorded. I would like to introduce your moderator for today's workshop, Lorena Tan Wang, Senior Education Program Manager at Cancer Care. Please go ahead.
Oh, thank you so much, Rob. And I too would like to welcome everyone to today's Cancer Care Connect Education Workshop, Cancer in the Workplace, Health Insurance, Finance, and Returning to School. We are delighted to be partnering with Stupid Cancer for this workshop today, and you'll be hearing more about them. Today's program is made possible through an independent grant from Merck and Company, Inc. and iSight, Inc. I really want to thank them for their support of today's program. And I just want to let you know how many people are on the call, what countries are on the call as well. So we have over 215 participants on the call, primarily from the United States, from both rural, urban, suburban, frontier communities. And we also have a number of international participants from Canada, India, Pakistan, Philippines, South Africa, and the United Kingdom. So it's a global call. And we're delighted to have you all on board, and we hope you learn a lot from our speakers. And now I'm going to introduce our first speaker. And our first speaker is Dr. Biswak Awutu. And Dr. Awutu is Assistant Attending Sarcoma Medical Oncology and Pediatric Sarcoma Service, Associate Director, Medical Oncology Hematology Fellowship, Memorial Sloan Kettering Cancer Center, Instructor in Medicine, Ball Cornell Medical College. And Dr. Awutu will be discussing overview of the challenges young adults living with cancer face, talking with the healthcare team about survivorship, questions, and concerns.
Thank you so much for the introduction, and welcome to everyone on the call. I know that these are both very, very heavy topics, and we could spend a lot of time on them, so I just want to kind of focus on some of, I think, the important aspects to really drive home, and then if there are any further questions, we can definitely go into more detail in the future. So really, I think especially this audience, you guys need no introduction to what the challenges are that you or your loved ones are facing. Cancer is a life-altering diagnosis, and with it comes so many ramifications to goals, to dreams, to aspirations, and I think hopefully you have heard from your medical team, we really want to try and minimize this. We recognize that certain things are going to change. You know, you will likely need some form of therapy, whether that's surgery or chemotherapy or radiation therapy or bone, you know, marrow transplant, any one of those or even maybe all of them. All of those have significant implications, but it's really as you move beyond that, really figuring out how to adapt your life with any complications or side effects or long-term issues that those treatments or the cancer itself may have led to. So one of the, I think, the most important things to discuss is the risk to long-term health. You know, many of the treatments we give, unfortunately, can cause damage to other parts of the body. So, for example, certain of the chemotherapy drugs may damage the heart, or they may damage your kidneys or your liver, and making sure you stay on top of that along with your medical team going forward is really important. The earlier we suspect or see evidence of any potential damage, the easier it will be to protect your body and therefore your health long term. But also if there is some damage, you know, we can do things to try and minimize that damage or more importantly, even sometimes reverse and heal the damage that may have occurred. Aside from that, I think it's a lot of what people present to the outside world. You know, cancer is a very personal, private thing, and some people choose to keep it that way. Some people choose to make it known to those in the outside world, whether it be family, friends, or even acquaintances, or just strangers that you may come across. Where you are in that spectrum, I think, is really your call to make, and your medical team can really speak to you about strategizing and navigating those issues. You should never feel like you have to disclose something or that you have to tell people, oh, I went through something like this or I'm going through this. That is really your call to make and no one else's call to make. I think the most important thing is to have the resources and the freedom to be able to express oneself and whatever feelings one has about those issues. I know I have several patients who are, you know, living very active life in college or right out of college, and they often struggle with saying, hey, I can't go out with my friends because I know what they would like to do, and I'm more worried about my liver health, and for me, it's not the right call right now. And I tell them, you know, speak to your friends. You know, could you come up with another plan where everyone can have fun? Or, you know, explain to them, hey, listen, I don't mind if you guys are enjoying, but just know that this is not the right thing to me. If you don't want to explain why, that's okay. You don't have to. And if they're your friends, they're going to understand that. But you should feel empowered to share what you are willing to share and no more than that. I think sometimes that also does allow you to have a further conversation of, hey, this is what I've been through. Can you help me make sure that I don't feel alone when we go out and, you know, people are offering me these things, like help me step in and be there for me. I think you can really use help your loved ones help you figure out what you're comfortable with. So, you know, I think we've talked a little about physical, medical stuff. We've also talked about social. But then there's that other realm of, like, what is it that you are doing in life, whether it's a job, whether it's being in school or college, finding a partner, thinking about having children. All of these are also severely impacted. So when you are going through treatment, the focus often is on just getting through that treatment, making sure you stay healthy, getting, you know, doing the things you need to do. I think to the extent possible, if you can work with the medical team and saying, hey, I find that being at school or being at my job helps me take a mental break from cancer and I want to maximize that as much as possible, we can try and construct our treatment so that we do allow that to happen whenever feasible. And then afterwards, when you enter the active survivorship phase and really think about long-term health, really prioritizing bringing back some of that normalcy back into your life. It's always going to be a new normal, but really thinking about, you know, how do I go back to school? Will I be maybe a little older than some of my colleagues? Will I have different life experiences? Of course. But don't look at that as something that should hold you back. You're going to bring a level of maturity or just a different experience that some others may not have, and that only enriches all of us. So don't look at that as a hurdle, but see that as you allow it, you are able to give back to the community you're going to be in. Financial toxicity, I know that several others are going to touch on as well, but this is a very relevant topic, both to the patients as well as to their loved ones. There are resources out there that I know we'll get into later in this call, but you should feel empowered to also go after those because it is not easy having gone through what you've been through or going through what you're going through. And there are resources out there to help, whether it's money or time or whatever that may be. There are always resources that can be leveraged to get you what you need. Sometimes it may not be physical, sometimes it may be virtual, but, you know, keep an open mind, adapt like you always do, and just never allow cancer to take more than it already has. I'm running a little low on time, so I'm going to shift a little in talking about survivorship and the concerns you may have. How do you collaborate with your medical team? How do you talk to medical professionals who may not know cancer survivorship in and out like your cancer team may know? I think, again, this is very critical because the rest of your life, you're going to be you have to be vigilant to what your body has been through. And that is another burden that's going to be tasked upon you. But being through what you've been through, you guys, you are all strong enough to do this. And it is so important that you don't forget. I know I have many patients tell me, I wish I could just forget about that scan, or do I really need to go do that additional blood work? And oftentimes the answer is yes, because it's going to protect you. And I know it's an inconvenience right now, and I know it's a huge ask, but if you do it, you are going to feel better in the long term. And I think that's important to remember. So you can work with your cancer team to really understand, well, what are the real long-term side effects? What has my body been through that I need to really pay attention to in the future? What are the symptoms that I could look for if I'm worried about something like this? Really, what are the screening tests? What will you be responsible for? And what should I work with my primary care physician or my non-cancer medical team about? How do we make sure there's seamless conversation between everyone so I always get the things I need to do? And for those that have to move for job and college and so forth, it's really making sure that you have a sense of what your body's been through. You have the cancer treatments you've been through, not necessarily in detail, but just a summary of everything, so that if you needed to, you could explain to someone else, hey, this is what I've been through. This is kind of the big things I'm at risk for. Is this something you need to worry about? And then the other thing is, you should never feel that you cannot ask about a certain topic. There is no taboo topic for survivorship. You know, whether it's sexual health, whether it's fertility, whether it's the uncertainty of the future, whether it's anxiety over what would happen if a scan shows another spot. All of those are fair game, and you should always feel free to ask us about that. We may not always have the solution, and oftentimes we won't, but we will partner with you to make sure you have as much information as we can give you, so you are making the right decisions for you and any life steps along the way. I think I'll stop there just to make sure I don't take up more time, but again, I'm happy to talk about any one of those topics in more detail.
Oh, thank you so much, Dr. Abutu. Your presentation was really wonderful, talking about the challenges young adults face and how to discuss survivorship concerns with the healthcare team. And I know there'll be questions for you during the Q&A. Thank you so much. Our next speaker is Dr. Kavita Ramaswamy. And Dr. Ramaswamy is Assistant Attending Pediatric Hematologic Malignancy Service, Memorial Sloan Kettering Cancer Center. And Dr. Ramaswamy will be discussing working during cancer treatment, suggestions from the healthcare team, young adult follow-up clinic, and dealing with physical changes due to cancer or its treatment, coping with the fear of cancer recurrence. And it's my great pleasure now to introduce this program to Dr. Ramaswamy.
Great, thank you so much. It's a lot to talk about, so I'll try to focus on a few points that I think are really important to discuss in this group, and of course, open for questions, from the group at the end. First, focusing on working during cancer, I actually like to think of this as either working or attending college, during cancer treatment. Certainly my patient population, I would say, skews a little bit heavier on patients that are trying to attend college, so are in college when their diagnosis occurs. So that can definitely be a very a significant impact on, life, especially if you are away at college. So I think it's a really important thing to talk about. And I think some of the issues that come up, of course, are really trying to understand an individual's specific treatment, because treatment protocols and can vary in so many different ways, both from kind of length of therapy and kind of type of therapy, intensive nature of treatment, how frequent visits are, is this, what type of treatment, IV infusions, is it primarily, pills. And so I think there's really just a lot to understand about an individual's treatment. And my point being that I think the more questions about that, and really specific questions, are really important to ask your healthcare team in order to understand what exactly to expect. And I think being open and honest right up at front, asking the important questions, and even just saying and being honest with you know, what your priorities are in terms of I would like to go back to college, you know, and how would that even work? Can that work? And I think those are just really important questions to just ask right up front. I think the other things are just to understand what options are even available, whether it's college or work. I think in this day and age, there really are a lot more options in terms of remote learning or hybrid working environments. So I think starting to even understand what those options may be. And I think part of that is going to also come into, again, with communicating well with the medical team in terms of making sure that the team knows what your priorities are. You know, are your priorities, you know, I'm okay to finish, you know, this semester, you know, home, but I really want to go back next semester or in the fall. And I think those are just really important, you know, things to kind of understand what priorities are in order to try to tailor as much as possible a treatment to those priorities for either college or work. But in my experience, I think it definitely has been really crucial to be able to know that those options of, you know, remote learning or remote hybrid work, because I think those are becoming easier to set up and establish for most places. And then I think, you know, asking all these questions really upfront, these are not, nobody's going to fault you for asking, because I think they're just so crucial for any individual's life to try to maintain their quality of life as much as possible. And I think trying to get as much information and then getting documentation, whether it's letters from the medical team or from social work, in order to be prepared for, you know, the requests for leave from work, for example, knowing what documents need to be filed for FMLA, the family medical leave, or if it's, you know, needing letters or documentation, medical documents for college in order to have potentially a medical leave, so you don't lose money maybe that was paid for tuition and things like that. So I think there really are a lot of things that can be addressed, I think these are all things that I would say most of us are very in tune to, but some of the priorities of that will just, I think they're important to just always be really mindful of and think about and say out loud, and nobody will fault you for doing that. And then another thing, just thinking about if, like for college, for example, if you are going to college away, certainly, you know, there could be situations where maybe I treat a lot of patients with leukemia, so maybe the treatment starts off, you know, closer to home and, you know, at your institution, but maybe then something can be coordinated to continuation of treatment with a local team that's closer to college that maybe you can integrate a little bit more back at school. So I think all of these things are potential options and opportunities to, you know, coordinate and continue with care as seamlessly as possible. I'm just, in the interest of time, I'm going to shift a little bit to the second kind of broad topic about dealing with physical changes due to cancer as treatment. Also another really big topic, but maybe just thinking of some general things that I like to, issues that I think are important to just bring up. And again, happy to talk about anything that comes up in the Q&A later on. But in terms of you know, physical changes during cancer, due to cancer and due to its treatment. But one of the issues that I see with this is just that the effects from treatment are so varied in terms of, you know, potentially what the expectations are from a given treatment, but then even expectations, you know, you could see so many different variations for an individual. And so I think asking, you know, what the expected side effects may be based on the really personalized treatment that's planned. Some of the things that I often facing are especially the really visible things such as hair loss with treatment. You know, I think that it's very much can be very distressing to lose hair. I know we always say hair grows back. You know, that's, I would say, for really majority of people, that overwhelming majority, that is the case. But there are a lot of things that, you know, during treatment, right, that you that really can be approached. It really could be potentially, you know, cutting hair shorter, you know, before it falls out, just so it's less annoying when it falls out. Potentially thinking about wigs. I think we're in the wintertime, so that's pretty helpful because, you know, hats really can mask a lot. You kind of need to wear a hat anyway. It's so cold. There are some research and some more established approaches, even with hair loss, that we could certainly think about and talk about. But I guess my point is just that there, these are well-known potential side effects, and there are things that can be really proactively done, either for attempt for prevention, or but also just to, you know, address the potentially inevitable physical change that can happen with most cancer treatments. There are other things that I certainly have seen and addressed in terms of, physical changes, potentially, you know, changes with like rashes and skin, stretch marks, things like that with certain types of treatments with steroids and things like that. And there are potential treatment options to try to address these that are not cosmetic. These are real, you know, physical changes. So, potentially approaches with that. And I think there are, of course, some really visible physical changes, and there are others that are not visible. I know was brought up things like, you know, potentially affecting like the liver with liver inflammation or kidneys. These are often not visible, but I think very significant physical changes that can happen. So I think definitely, I think a lot of pressing conversations about the really physical hair and other skin changes and things. But I think it's really important to also be open with the team so that, you know, that your team knows what your priorities are. It may or may not be hair. It may be something else. So I think, you know, again, just open communication right at the beginning and certainly during treatment are so critical to try to address, you know, all these potential physical changes that may or may not be expected to happen. And I think I'll stop there. I think I have my timing right out of time.
Thank you so much, Dr. Ramaswamy. A stellar presentation discussing the different options available, whether it be work or education, and how to deal with physical changes. And I know there'll be questions for you during the Q&A. Thank you so much. And our next speaker is Ms. Deborah Wolf. Ms. Wolf is a senior supervising attorney, Legal Health, New York Legal Assistant Group, NILAC. And Ms. Wolf will be discussing school, deciding how to deal with financing, education, community college, technical training, college, graduate school, scholarship. Financial concerns including health insurance, school, college, and career, and knowing your rights, ADA, Americans with Disability Act, FMLA, Family Medical Leave Act, and additional legal protection. My great pleasure now to turn this program to Ms. Wolf.
Thanks so much, Lorena, and I'm very pleased to be a part of this teleconference with Cancer Care and Stupid Cancer. I'll first briefly discuss loans and scholarships, then health insurance, and the laws that offer protection in both school and the workplace. Whether in high school or already in college, my best advice is to speak to your college counselor or, if in college, the financial aid counselor about options that are available to finance your education. There are different types of loans, including federally funded and private loans for both students and their parents, if their parents are able to financially assist. Besides financial aid from your school, there are many scholarships out there. So do your online research and talk with your college counselor. Many cancer organizations provide scholarship help, and I believe Cancer Care will be providing information on this. Attend college fairs, as there's usually somebody information on financial aid, whether it's a college, university, or technical school. It's also okay to communicate with the financial aid office if your college is not offering enough support. When my daughter chose a college, she did not receive any scholarship offers, and she wrote a letter to her first choice college outlining her accomplishments and why this was her college of choice, and they wrote back and offered her a generous combination of scholarship and funding for summer work. So it's always worth an ask. You never know. If you are in school and you need to take a medical leave or ask for accommodations, you're protected by a law called the Rehabilitation Act of 1973, which forbids organizations that receive federal funding from excluding or denying individuals with disabilities an equal opportunity to receive program benefits and service. And this law applies to primary, secondary schools, and colleges. Colleges have individualized policies for medical leaves of absence, so it's hard to discuss them generally here, but these policies outline the steps you need to take to maintain or reinstate your financial aid upon your return. Typically, federal student aid, such as Pell Grants and direct loans, are affected by enrollment status. If you take a leave of absence, especially if it extends beyond a certain period, your enrollment status may change, and if you drop below half-time enrollment, it could affect your eligibility for certain types of aid or school-based health insurance. Colleges and universities typically have disability services. They have offices that work with students to also determine appropriate accommodations based on their individual needs. So it's crucial to communicate with them as soon as you anticipate the need for a leave of absence or an accommodation such as extra time to take an exam. I want to add that certain student loans are dischargeable if the student becomes disabled due to a cancer diagnosis. To qualify, a doctor must certify on a discharge form that you are unable to engage in any substantial gainful activity due to a physical impairment that will last for a period of at least 60 months. And you're also eligible if you're approved for Social Security disability. A loan discharge does not prohibit future work or even part-time work. Each type of financial aid has their own rules and requirements, so best to reach out to the loan provider to ask for loan discharge forms. Also, many employers have loan payment assistance, and there is a loan discharge after a certain amount of years for employees in the public service or nonprofit work. I'm going to move to health insurance now. A health insurance marketplace operates in every state, and in the marketplace, you can compare different plan benefits, see if you're entitled to subsidies to lower the cost, and determine if you're eligible for free coverage under Medicaid. All plans must cover essential health benefits, which is a long list, which includes outpatient and emergency services, prescriptions, hospitalization, mental health and preventive care, and more. If you're a student, your college may also offer health coverage, although some of these policies have limitations. So it's important to ask for a copy and read through. They generally only cover you while in school. So if your college is in one state and you live in another state, you may need more coverage than what the school offers. Under the Affordable Care Act, a person can continue to be covered under their parents' work-based health insurance until age 26. So this is also an option. And if a parent is working, work-based health insurance is often more comprehensive coverage. Medicaid may also be an option in your state if your income is lower. Eligibility rules are established mainly by each state, and they vary depending on where you live. Medicaid is free, and to be eligible, you must fall below the income and asset limits set forth by the Medicaid laws. Medicaid plans with higher income limits are also offered in many states for patients with certain types of cancer or for working people with disabilities. And as I mentioned before, one application on the marketplace can determine your eligibility for Medicaid or another health plan, as well as any subsidies. If you qualify for Social Security disability, Medicare is offered after 18 months. Medicare alone is not sufficient to cover the costs of care, and either a private policy or Medicaid is needed to supplement Medicare. As daunting as it sounds, I think the most important advice I can give is to read a copy of your policy. It will outline any limitations, because even with the protections under the Affordable Care Act, policies can still limit certain coverages. And if you have questions, reach out to your insurance company to discuss your concerns and coverage questions, as they can often be very helpful. Next, I'm going to give an overview of the laws protecting against discrimination based on disability in school, work, and during medical leave. My focus will be on the federal laws that apply to all 50 states, but I urge you to become familiar with your state laws as they often provide even greater protections. I'm going to begin with the Americans with Disabilities Act, or as often called the ADA. It's a federal law and applies equally to all 50 states, to everyone who works for an employer with 15 or more employees. The ADA has a broad definition of what is considered a qualified disability, and it includes illnesses that have gone into remission, such as cancer. So as a result, cancer is covered under the law as a qualified disability, even if somebody is in remission. The ADA has two main benefits. The first is that it requires an employer to make reasonable accommodations when requested by an employee. This allows an employee to go to human resources or their boss if no human resources and request a modification of their work schedule, work environment, or company policies. What's reasonable is determined on a case-by-case basis, but an employer must grant the request unless it creates an undue hardship, which is a pretty tough burden for the employer to establish. Some common accommodations I have helped people with cancer set up include a later work start time due to the side effects of medication, a shorter work day, or an extra break during the day to rest or have something to eat. Since COVID and people working remotely, many employees have also asked for fully remote work, but it's important to remember that you have to be able to do the essential functions of your job, so working from home may not always be an option for everyone. There's no set list of accommodations, and there's a terrific website called the Job Accommodation Network, askjan.org, askjan.org, and it provides detailed information with suggestions for accommodations based on the disability and the impairments. The employee must request the accommodation, and an employer can't refuse an accommodation, but they can negotiate. You know, they can say, this isn't going to work, but let's talk about what might work for both of us. But it has to be an interactive process. But the burden is on the employee to come forward and request. So it's important to do this if you feel that your illness or treatment is impacting your work. I always suggest that the accommodation request be made in writing with a letter of support from your doctor, certifying that the accommodation is medically necessary. I also suggest that the letter specifically state that the employee is able to perform their essential job functions with the accommodation. The second ADA benefit is that the law prohibits discrimination against an employee because of a disability, and this includes hiring, firing, demoting, or harassment. So if someone's working and believes they're being treated unfairly, they should first try to resolve through human resources. And if the concern remains unresolved, a person can file a complaint with the EEOC, the Equal Employment Opportunity Commission. And if this is your choice, make sure to speak to an attorney to understand any deadlines as well as applicable state and federal laws. The next law I want to discuss is the Family Medical Leave Act, often called FMLA. An FMLA applies to employers with 50 or more employees, and to be covered, you must have worked at your job for 12 months. The employer gets to choose if they want to use a 12-month calendar year from January to December. or start the 12 months running from the date FMLA is requested. So if you request FMLA protection, let's say on June 1st, your FMLA year is going to run from June 1st of 2024 through the end of May of 2025, and most employers do it that way. Employee benefits such as health insurance must continue for 12 weeks, although you may continue to pay any, you must continue to make any contributions to the premiums. FMLA also allows for intermittent leave, which may include a few hours a week for treatment or a doctor visit. So as an example, an employee with treatment every other Thursday could request FMLA leave every other Thursday afternoon and Friday if needed to recuperate if all your sick time is used up. And with FMLA, your job will be protected for up to 12 weeks worth of time off. If your FMLA protected time is used up and you think you may be able to return to work shortly, additional time can be requested as a reasonable accommodation under the ADA. And if you work for a smaller company and don't qualify for FMLA, time off for treatment can also be requested as an ADA accommodation. While applying and interviewing for jobs, employers can't ask any direct health or disability questions. I usually suggest that if someone needs an accommodation, get the job first and then request the accommodation. There's no time you have to wait. You can request the accommodation after the job is set up. The only reason to disclose is for a reasonable accommodation or FMLA leave, and it should be human resources. Often fellow employees and even supervisors and managers don't understand these laws and what their responsibilities are. And there's no law that prohibits a coworker from sharing this information with others. So think carefully of who you want to disclose to. I think I want to stress that I speak to many people who are working through their treatment, who have employers and coworkers who are incredibly supportive. And I don't want to give the impression that there's always problems. But it's up to the individual to decide if disclosure is needed, and I just urge everyone to think it through and do what's best for them. And I think I'll end there and then be available for any questions.
Thank you so much, Ms. Wolf. Excellent presentation talking about financial concerns for school and health insurance and your legal protections. I know there'll be questions for you during the Q&A. Thank you very much. And our next speaker is Ms. Melody Griffith. Ms. Griffith is outpatient adolescent and young adult AYA oncology social worker, instructor in social work, Mayo Clinic College of Medicine and Science, section of social work, Mayo Clinic, Arizona. And Ms. Griffith will be discussing the role of the oncology social worker, short and long-term follow-up for young adult cancer survivors, guidelines to prepare for telehealth telemedicine appointments, including technology, prepare list of questions, quality of life concerns, and discussion of open notes. It's my great pleasure to introduce Ms. Griffith.
Hi, everyone. Thanks for having me on here today. I'm going to only briefly touch on the part about preparing for office visits, virtual visits, and things like that. We talked a little bit about that last week. So I always encourage people to have a list of questions to talk to their providers about, because sometimes when we meet with our providers, our minds go blank. It happens to me too. So having a prepared list of questions that you or your loved ones have to prioritize how you want that conversation to go, because that's your time and you should be able to dictate a little bit of how that goes. So having that prepared is great. Being prepared for virtual visits requires making sure that you have access to the right technology, a good internet connection, that you're in a place that's quiet and private, that you can have those conversations that might be a little bit more sensitive with your providers. And then definitely using your medical record chart. There's a lot of good information in there. There's a lot of things that could be confusing. So just make sure that you look through that. And if there's something that doesn't make sense to you, talk with your provider about that or a nurse who can maybe help translate some of it if it's a little bit in doctor speak and it's harder to understand. So just make sure that you're looking at that and things make sense and are accurate too, because there might be something in there that you would like updated to better reflect something that's going on in your life or with your situation. The part I'd like to spend a little bit more time on is how social workers and other care team members can support you in the short and long term, and how we address quality of life concerns during survivorship. And for people, survivorship might mean through treatment, and for some people it might mean once the cancer is gone and you have completed treatment. So just keep that in mind as I talk about a few things. So as survivors transition from active treatment to survivorship, or if you have a change in a treatment plan, or if there isn't any more treatment that will be helpful, it is a time of changes, and sometimes it's a time of big challenges also. It can be helpful to talk with your care team about what support is available to you during that time, and that could mean physical, financial, emotional. It could be a chaplain that could support you during those transition times as well. And it's important that you understand that you have a follow-up care plan, regardless of your stage, as I mentioned before. If it's transitioning to a new treatment plan, you need to know what that's going to look like. If you're done with treatment, you need to know what the follow-up appointments will be. And to make sure that you can have that communication with your team so that you feel supported in identifying and dealing with the mixed emotions that come with someone who, for example, has finished treatment or is changing treatment. There might be relief or anxiety or uncertainty or all of the above. And we want to make sure that you get connected to the right staff and to meaningful resources. For example, you might need help in the process of returning to work, too. That's a more practical example. Or for school, or figuring out how to approach existing or new relationships. It could even be that you need help just knowing what questions to ask your employer, your school, or your providers. So there are team members that can help kind of walk you through that process and know what questions to ask based on what's important to you at this stage of treatment or survivorship and in your life. And it's important to note that your cancer experience does not end when the treatments do. Over the time that after you finish treatment, your needs and challenges will likely change. They can be physical late effects, mental health concerns, fear of recurrence. You could be going through things like starting a new career or choosing an educational path, starting a family, developing relationships. All of those things are significant transitions in anyone's life, but they could bring up emotions that are then impacted by your health history and your treatment. AYA-specific support groups or mentorship programs can create spaces where you can receive and give support to other people in similar situations. So it's the people that get it and understand, even more so than your care team. The point is of most of those groups is to help you feel less alone and more empowered as a young adult who is going through something related to cancer. Sometimes it helps to talk about how you're feeling with someone who isn't a family member or friend. Some people feel that they can be more honest with someone who isn't emotionally attached to them, and some need a reminder that what they're feeling and thinking is probably pretty normal for what they're going through. And if those thoughts or feelings are getting in the way of everyday life and activities, then someone on your care team, such as a social worker, can help point you in the direction of working through those things. Quality of life is important to us throughout treatment, your diagnosis, treatment, and survivorship. And it does you really no good if we fix the cancer and leave everything else really messy. So social workers and other mental health professionals can work with you to help address body image concerns, identity shifts in relationships and goals, the emotional uncertainty that comes with living through and beyond cancer as well. So for families and caregivers, we provide tools to help navigate challenging roles and relationships during survivorship. We can also help you become your best advocate, whether that's communicating your needs to healthcare teams or finding ways to stay engaged within your outer community. Being an oncology social worker for me means walking alongside you as you move forward, and sometimes backwards and sometimes sideways, depending on how you are and what you're going through. We're here to help you navigate those practical things, the emotional things, and the social aspects of cancer treatment and survivorship so that you can live a fulfilling and supported life beyond and in spite of cancer. I encourage you to reach out to social workers. If you have one, that's great. If you don't have one, you might and just might not know them, so ask. If the answer is no, we don't have social workers for you, ask who on the care team can support you emotionally and practically. We are here to be a part of your team, and we're really in it with you for the long haul. And I think that's how most providers want to approach your care as well. So they will do their best to connect you to good resources. So I hope you'll be able to utilize those. Thank you for letting me spend some time with you.
Oh, thank you so much, Ms. Griffith. Stellar presentation discussing the role of social worker and the other healthcare team. I know there'll be questions for you during the Q&A. Thank you very much. And our next speaker is Mr. Matthew Marroquin. Mr. Marroquin is Program and Community Coordinator at Stupid Cancer. And Mr. Marroquin will be discussing Stupid Cancer's free programs and services and also provide how to contact them. My great pleasure now to turn this program to Mr. Marroquin.
Hello, hello. As I was introduced, my name is Matthew Marroquin, Program Community Coordinator here at Stupid Cancer. I'm just going to get this real quickly out here and tell you a little bit about what Stupid Cancer does. Our mission is to empower everyone affected by adolescent and young adult cancer. For us, it's ages 15 to 39. And by ending isolation and building community, that's our main portion. We aim to have all AYAs feel supported, understood, and accepted through our programs. So our programs are, you know, the headlining program that we do every year that even Cancer Care is at is CancerCon, which is held once a year. It's a conference that brings AYAs together, building connections. There's breakout sessions. There's karaoke. There's a lot of dance party. There's a lot of fun things, but also a variety of cancer topics like sex and intimacy, mental health, insurance paperwork, you know, being a young adult. And amazing, it's just an amazing social experience where hundreds of AYAs come together for this live experience. And next year, it's actually going to be in D.C., so not too far if you're from the New York City metropolitan area. And that's going to be in next August. We also have like discussion sessions where we go throughout the year. These are online where we have a professional talk about subject matter, just, you know, for 20 minutes or so. And then there's a discussion where only the AYA community is allowed to be in with the professional there to kind of help moderate, to talk deeper about some of these topics I mentioned before, such as mental health, fertility, identity, et cetera. You can share your stories with us if you're one that I want to tell somebody, I need to tell the world. We have Stupid Cancer Stories, which is a great way to share your cancer story, whether you're a writer, you want to read it, you want to record it, whatever it might be, we're here to help make that happen. Finally, we also have meetups. We do both virtual meetups. So you can go to our page, stupidcancer.org, and go to our calendar. We have a meetup coming this Monday virtually. We have some special meetups such as book clubs, game nights, et cetera, throughout the year as well, at least a monthly. And every week we have our virtual Monday meetups. And then we also have live meetups throughout the nation. So whether you want to find what's going on, you can go to our calendar. We have a lot in New York happening, obviously, but we've had some in California this past year. We've had some in Minneapolis. We've had some in Florida. And if you think you want to be a meetup host, just send me an email or send a message to contact@stupidcancer.org. Again, you can find all this and more at stupidcancer.org.
Thank you so much, Mr. Marroquin. Stellar. Thank you for sharing the different programs from Stupid Cancer. We are delighted to be partnering with you on all of our young adult programs. And I know there'll be questions for you during the Q&A. Thank you so much. And our next speaker is Ms. Haley Fuchs. Ms. Fuchs is the Cancer Care's Young Adult Program Coordinator. And Ms. Fuchs will be discussing Cancer Care's free programs and services and also our Hope Line number and our website.
Thank you, Lorena. So my name is Haley Fuchs. I'm the Young Adult Program Coordinator at Cancer Care, and I'd like to take this opportunity to address the psychosocial impact that a cancer diagnosis can have on the young adult population, and also highlight some of Cancer Care's programs that can be of assistance. Before I get started, I just want to provide a brief review of Cancer Care. Cancer Care is a national nonprofit organization which provides free professional support services and information to help people manage the emotional, practical, and financial challenges of cancer. And I'm going to provide a brief review of our services. a cancer diagnosis can be very overwhelming, and additional support and guidance may help to relieve feelings of anxiety. Working one-on-one with an oncology social worker through individual counseling can offer a space to express one's feelings, emotions, and concerns. Cancer Care offers free cancer-focused counseling to individuals impacted by cancer for those who live in New York and New Jersey. And joining a support group can also be a way of getting additional support throughout this time. Being a member in a support group can offer the opportunity to speak with others, gather, and provide support, as well as obtain information. Cancer Care offers online support groups for young adults across the country. These groups take place using a password-protected message board format and are led by professional oncology social workers. Groups are held at 15 weeks at a time, and you can register on our website. We are currently offering a few groups specifically for young adults diagnosed with cancer, as well as young adult caregivers and young adults who have lost a loved one to cancer. Young adults diagnosed with cancer may experience practical and financial concerns throughout their treatment, and it may be helpful to discuss any financial concerns with your medical providers, social workers, patient navigators, as well as the financial department at your treatment center. Cancer Care offers some limited financial assistance to young adults with certain diagnoses who qualify. Cancer Care also offers free telephone resource navigation to young adults with cancer, also those who are post-treatment and caregivers. And these services are provided by professional resource navigators and oncology social workers. And the service is available in English and Spanish. And resource navigation centers kind of on the practical challenges that can arise from cancer, and staff provide clients with resources, referrals, and potential financial assistance options. Finally, on Cancer Care's website, there's also a variety of reading material and information related to young adults coping with cancer. This includes recorded Connect education workshops, Cancer Care Out Loud, the Cancer Care podcast, and multiple publications, as well as stories of help and hope in both general and specific resources. We also have coping circle workshops. Specifically, we have an upcoming coping circle called Adolescent and Young Adult Cancer Chronicles, which will take place in April of 2025. And we also have recorded and uploaded previous years' YA Cancer Chronicles on our website, which you can find the recorded versions of. We also have an upcoming free young adult writing workshop on January 29th. If you're interested in learning more about our supportive services, I encourage you to explore our website and, of course, call Cancer Care's National Hope Line at 800-813-4673 to speak to one of our oncology social workers. Thank you so much for your attention, and I will now turn it back to Lorena.
Thank you so much, Ms. Fuchs. Wonderful discussion on the importance of support groups and the different services we offer. And now we're going to move on to the Q&A. We're going to take as many questions as possible, so I'm going to ask Rob to explain to you how to queue up for questions. Rob?
Thank you. Ladies and gentlemen, at this time, we will take questions from the web only. You may submit questions by clicking Ask a Question.
First question for Ms. Wolf. After being diagnosed with cancer, will I be considered a disabled person? So when I apply for a job, should I check mark that status?
So the answer to the first part of your question is yes, generally, you know, cancer is included as a qualified disability. The answer to your second question is really, it depends. For most jobs during an application, an employee is not required to disclose any disabilities. There are exceptions. So, for example, if somebody is applying for a job involving public safety, like a bus driver or a police officer, they may have to be more forthcoming in terms of any disabilities because that could impact their ability to do that job. But generally, you know, my advice is, as I said before, you know, to get the job, and then once you have the job to ask for any accommodations. Once a job is offered, an employer can ask for a medical review, but they have to ask that equally of everybody. So they can't single out a prospective employee and, you know, say that we want that person to go through a medical exam. It has to be an equal medical test for anybody coming into that job. But that's really the only time that an employer can make medical inquiries. Again, with the exception of somebody who works at a public safety job.
Thank you so much, Ms. Wu. Question for Dr. Wotu and Dr. Ramaswamy. What steps are being taken to educate and inform those who are at a higher risk to develop cancer at a younger age? Are these programs that promote screening?
So I can take first pass at that. So there are guidelines put out by some of the national groups. So, for example, Children's Oncology Group, ASCO, and these large cancer care organizations that will outline if this is the type of chemotherapy you've had or the type of treatment you've had, this is what you should do with some general guidelines. However, I would really encourage you to talk to the medical team, to the cancer care team who knows you best about really tailoring that treatment plan for what you're going to need going forward. Oftentimes, at some of the larger cancer centers, there will be a survivorship team who can kind of help manage that. But if you're at a less resource center, sometimes the primary care team will really be responsible for that. But you should feel very comfortable saying, okay, this is the treatment I've gotten. What should I do going forward? What are the symptoms that I should really look out for? That latter part is a little more difficult because sometimes it's hard to be like, oh, you know, we can't cover everything. But really what I remind people is if something feels off, ask. It's better that we know than you kind of ignoring it. You know, keep in mind, you're a young person. You're going to get the thing all young people get. You're going to get the flu, the cold, the cough, all of those things. But if it doesn't behave like what it should, like, then that's when we start to get concerned.
Thank you, Dr. Wutu. Dr. Ramaswamy, you have anything to add?
I don't have too much more to add. I just wanted to say that there are definitely really standard surveillance guidelines for post-treatment, which is very much tailored towards an individual's treatment. But, you know, again, just like Dr. Wutu said, you know, there are certain things that even beyond that would be particularly individualized. So I think, you know, having a plan in place, I think is crucial. And whether it's at a survivorship clinic that's, you know, linked to a cancer center or, you know, having a plan for, you know, if you were to move and go to like a local PCP, you know, but having, you know, your medical history really clearly outlined for them to ultimately know, you know, what to follow, you know, and what interval and things like that is, I think, probably the best thing.
Thank you, Dr. Ramaswamy. Question for Ms. Griffith and also Ms. Fuchs. Some of my closest friendships have changed since I was diagnosed with breast cancer. They act awkward around me now, and they treat me differently. How can I mention this to them? I've tried to hint at it in the past, but they don't understand.
I'll say something quickly here. I think that that is a wonderful question, and unfortunately something that a lot of young adults experience. Sometimes it's called cancer ghosting or just that change in relationship. So totally you are heard on that, and it definitely happens. I think it depends on your friendship for some people and kind of your communication style also. So for some people, pointing it out might be the best route, you know, not hinting at it because humans are great at some things, but picking up on hints sometimes isn't it. So saying, hey, you know, I feel like things are a little bit different since I've had treatment. Sometimes, too, pointing it out is helpful, but it's also people don't know what to do or what to say. So if you could kind of think of like, okay, if how would I want them to respond or how would I want them to treat me, then give them some examples. That might be helpful, too, so that they know what you're expecting. It could be that they're just afraid they're going to say something offensive or that it's going to bring up hard stuff. So you can really take that first step of saying, hi, I'm going to address the elephant in the room and let you know kind of where I'm at and how I would hope that you would respond to me.
Ms. Fuchs, and that.
Yeah, I was going to say pretty much the same thing. I think that's, you know, those are great suggestions. I think also, you know, if you're nervous about having that conversation with your friend, which is, you know, definitely understandable, maybe role playing with someone who you do feel comfortable, you know, talking to and who is more comfortable, you know, talking about the diagnosis, just so that you can kind of practice, because again, it can be a difficult conversation for sure.
Thank you so much. And one more question for Mr. Marroquin and Ms. Fuchs. Do you know of any support groups or resources for parents with cancer, specifically those who are raising young children?
So that's a good question. I would say that as a caregiver, especially within our age range, we do hold some more so social events, so you can meet other people who are also going through that similar experience, but not exactly, we don't do support groups in the common sense. I do think cancer care does hold a little bit more of that, so I think Kaylee can elucidate a little bit more on that.
Yes, we don't have a specific group for young adult parents, but that is definitely a topic that comes up in our young adult support groups in general and also caregiver groups. So if you live in New York and New Jersey, we have Zoom groups. If you're not in the New York, New Jersey area, we have a different kind of group, which is our online support group, which is kind of like a message platform for young adults, and that is also a topic that comes up in that group. Also, going on Psychology Today to, if you're not in that area and if you're looking for more of a Zoom group or a in-person group, looking on Psychology Today to see if there's any support groups in your zip code.
Thank you. And now I would like to ask our speakers to provide takeaways. We'll go in the order of the presentation, so Dr. Awutu, Dr. Ramaswamy, Ms. Wolf, Ms. Griffith, Mr. Marroquin, and Ms. Fuchs, takeaway for today's program.
Thanks, Lorena. I think the biggest takeaway is to feel empowered to advocate for yourself, to make sure that your healthcare needs are being met, and not to shy away from having tough discussions on your own terms.
Dr. Ramaswamy.
Oh, great. Yeah. And I think from my perspective, I think it's really, knowing what is important to you, whether it is trying to get back to school or work or, you know, what types of things are, you know, truly going to be, on top of mind in terms of like body changes, with treatment, physical changes, and so just be in open communication with your team about what those priorities are.
Thank you. Ms. Wolf?
I would say first to make sure you understand your health policy and your benefits, read the summary of benefits, and ask questions to understand your insurance policies and your work benefits. And second, if you are working, use human resources if you feel you're being discriminated against or need to set up an accommodation. Be proactive to avoid any adverse action as a result of any discrimination. Coworkers and supervisors often have to be educated about the laws that we discussed, and that's the role of human resources. So reach out to them if you have any questions, concerns, or problems.
Thank you. Ms. Griffith?
Hi. So I would say make sure that you are your biggest advocate. I know that's tiring, but you know yourself better than anyone else. So expressing your needs and concerns is very important. I wanted to add on too to that last question about support for parents. There is a program called CLIMB, C-L-I-M-B also, that is for parents and their kids that are ages 6 to 17. So it's the parent has a cancer diagnosis, and we've done it at our institution in the past. They also have a virtual option as well. So that might be something to look into, where the parents get their own support, the kids get their own, and then they come together and share some of those skills that are learned. So if that's available in your area, I highly recommend that as an option as well.
Thank you, Mr. Marroquin.
Yeah, I actually just thought of that after after I passed it on, but definitely check out our programming at stupidcancer.org. We do have a lot of things going on with Stupid Cancer, and if there's things that we don't offer, we partner with so many different organizations. I would definitely check out our resources and our resource guide, because if we don't offer it, it's definitely in there. So check us out.
Thank you, Ms. Fuchs.
Yeah, I would say the biggest takeaway for me was that, you know, you're not alone. So we want to emphasize that, you know, there's support, whether it's, you know, through cancer care, through Stupid Cancer, or, you know, any of the other young adult programs. You're not alone, and we hear you.
Thank you so much. I want to thank all of our speakers. You've been phenomenal. And I also want to thank all of our participants. Today's program was particularly exceptional just because of the questions that people asked on the call and the way our speakers addressed those questions. I do want to say a few words for those of you that didn't have your questions answered. And I would like you to go back to your healthcare team and ask them your questions. And even if your question was answered today, go back to your healthcare team and ask them. Remember, you learned a great deal from today's program, and I want you to take what you've learned and go back to your treating healthcare team and ask your questions. Also, I do want to remind everyone that it is very important to know who to contact on evenings, weekends, and holidays. Oftentimes, that is when you need to reach them the most. I do appreciate your participation today, and I want to wish you all a very fine day. Thank you.
Ladies and gentlemen, thank you for your participation. This concludes the workshop, and you may now disconnect. Everyone have a great day.